Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of September. Thanks to John Munson for filling in for me yesterday while I was feeling a bit under the weather, but I'm better today. This hour of the program, William Sapphire, our subject. He died on Sunday, and he had such an incredible life. He called himself and said the word may have been coined for him, a pundit. Until early this month, very shortly before he died, he continued writing On Language, a column that explored written and oral trends, described the origins and meanings of words and phrases, and he had many devoted readers. He wrote about the rules for writing, saying, "Remember to never split an infinitive. Take the bull by the hand and avoid mixing metaphors. Proofread carefully to see if you words out. Avoid cliches like the plague and don't overuse exclamation marks," followed by three exclamation marks. The consensus is that his op-ed essays, which he wrote for many years, twice a week in the New York Times, and it was syndicated in hundreds of newspapers, were the work of a sophisticated analyst with many contacts and insights into the way that things worked in Washington. His last column was a very good one. He talked about retiring and said, "Never retire. Your brain needs exercise. Never retire, but plan to change your career to keep your synapses strong. Retraining and fresh stimulation are what all of us should require in the last of life for which the first was made. So you need to look at your avocation. The trick is to start early in our careers, the stress-relieving avocation that we will need later as a mind-exercising final vocation. We can quit a job, but we quit fresh involvement at our own mental peril." We have three guests with us this hour to talk about the life of William Sapphire, his political life, and the life on language. Marty Grothy joining us, the first part of our show, author of Oxymoronica, Paradoxical Wit and Wisdom from History's Greatest Wordsmiths. And most recently, we talked with Marty recently, Ifarisms, an anthology of aphorisms that begin with the word if. Later this hour, Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, who said that William Sapphire had an enormous impact on how liberal journalists were very careful to say negative things about conservative politicians. Jay Nordlinger, journalist and senior editor of the National Review, will also join us to explore his long career and some of the more fascinating things he did during his life. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. I'm sure that many of you followed his writings pretty carefully. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we start with Marty. Hello, Marty. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. I'm glad to hear you're feeling better.
Thank you. Yeah, it was just a day-long thing. It wasn't the swine flu, at least not
yet. Good.
Yeah. I used to love his language column. I appreciated his writing as well, but the guy was quite a wordsmith, and he was a college dropout.
Well, it was even worse than that. He was fond of saying that he was at the bottom of his high school class at the Bronx School of Science.
Oh, my gosh.
So, of course, you know, he played that to the hilt. But what is fascinating about him is that he has become known as America's language maven, but he didn't have any credentials. You know, I mean, he did drop out of Syracuse University, and he got discovered in 1959 when he was a public relations guy. Do you know that story?
Is that the kitchen debate?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, tell us that story.
At a trade show, and right. You know, he's working for this kitchen manufacturer, and he somehow manages to get Nikita Khrushchev and Richard Nixon into the same space, and they start talking to one another. Snaps a picture of it, and he's a PR guy, of course, and he calls it the kitchen debate, and Nixon was so impressed, he hired him the next year.
Isn't that something? A self-made guy who knew how to turn a phrase.
Boy, he did. Yeah, he had a lifelong love affair with the English language, and you know, I'm a major league quotation collector, and he's got hundreds and hundreds of just masterful expressions. In your introduction, you offered a number of those what we call self-contradictory quotations, and you know that happened. That all happened the very first year he began writing his On Language column in the New York Times. He laid out what he called three perverse rules of grammar. And what was interesting about them is each one of them, he phrased the rule in a way that broke the rule he was laying out. You know, so instead of saying, you know, never use a long word when a short one will do, he said, never use a long word when a diminutive one will do. And of course, what happened was his readers just got all on top of this. And, I mean, he created a whole new national fad for a short period of time when people are trying to come up with what were called perverse rules of grammar.
He also, and this, when I think about it, so many politicians use this now, this phrase-making technique using, as you point out, a repeated rhythm with an inversion or substitution of words for emphasis.
Oh, yes.
He was a master at that.
Well, you know, the formal name for that figure of speech is called chiasmus. And, you know, we know that from John Kennedy's Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You. In fact, I have a wonderful example of chiasmus from Sapphire himself. I was working on my very first book back in the middle 1990s when I was researching these, and I came across this wonderful quote from Sapphire where he said, "It's better to be a jerk that knees than a knee that jerks." And, you know, I didn't quite know exactly what he meant by
it. I don't either. Good, I'm glad you didn't either.
Can I offer you the quick explanation?
Please.
Because it's fascinating. Sapphire, of course, he was a speechwriter for Nixon and Agnew, but he called himself a libertarian conservative. And so he wasn't one of these ideological neoconservatives. He was kind of a conservative that oftentimes went pretty liberal, and he hated knee-jerk politicians. You know, these kind of politicians that were so ideologically driven that they just took a position because their political beliefs said that's the way you're supposed to believe.
Yes.
So his point was that it's better to be a jerk that knees, that is, a person who fights dirty, than to be a knee that jerks.
Oh.
And you know, he eventually proved the truth of that in his own life because later on when the Iraq War happened, he was a staunch supporter of the invasion of Iraq, but at the very same time, he vigorously opposed the Patriot Act, and he actually said some pretty critical things about the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. So he was not a knee-jerk conservative. He was, as he said, sometimes a jerk that knees.
Huh, isn't that something? He was a good friend. I was listening to NPR yesterday, and Daniel Shore gave this wonderful tribute to him. They were very, very good friends. You wouldn't imagine that they would be, but evidently William Sapphire went to bat for Daniel Shore.
Well, you know, now when we have so much a political divide in this country, it is kind of fascinating that these older conservatives and liberals, like those two gentlemen that you just referred to, actually could have great affection to one another. And so they didn't let their politics kind of get in the way of their relationships with one another. There's a wonderful story about, I think it was 1974, when for the very first time the New York Times hired this William Sapphire, this conservative columnist, and he, I think, even said that he became the first conservative voice in the liberal chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the New York Times has got this history of being filled with liberals, and he was not accepted right away. And apparently, very, very early on, within the first month or two, he was at a party at the home of a number of these journalists, and the son of one of the New York Times journalists fell into a swimming pool, and just instantly Sapphire dove into the pool fully clothed, grabbed the son, pulled him out, and right then and there he won over all of these liberals who had viewed him previously with great suspicion.
Oh, I love that story.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. What about this nattering nabobs of negativism? What was that, a phrase directed at the press, or was it directed at those who believed that Vietnam was going down the tubes?
Well, you know, who knows? I mean, Sapphire was fond of alliteration. And so, in fact, I don't know, did you, one of his perverse rules of grammar was avoid awkward or affected alliteration. And he was the speechwriter for Spiro Agnew, and we all remember those days of, you know, all the students were protesting the Vietnam War, and there was lots of negative press coverage. And in one of Spiro Agnew's speeches, he talked about the nattering nabobs of negativism. Well, you know, I don't know exactly if he had in mind the students or the press, but it was probably both. And that became, I think that became the most famous political line of the year.
It sure
the
did.
Irony is, I don't think Spiro Agnew even knew what nabobs meant.
He probably didn't. I was looking at some of his earlier columns, his column on baseball, where would politicians, pundits, and morose mucky-mucks be without the language of baseball? And then he goes on to talk about how everybody has been using this. Last year, candidate Obama took the sting out of criticism by the scribes for playing ball with the Chicago Fixer by admitting right off the bat that his property purchase was boneheaded. Palin showed she had something on the ball, considered 2008 a warm-up in the bullpen, and took a rain check for 2012 when she hopes to knock the ball out of the park unless she gets thrown by a curve by the rise of Romney.
Oh, my God. Talk about a metaphorical tour de force there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He did. He loved to speak in metaphorical language. He once said, English is a stretch language. One size fits all.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of neat.
And he kept writing this column until earlier this month, right before he died. It obviously was very important to him.
Well, he did. You know, he, at age 75, as you pointed out in your introduction, you know, he wrote his last op-ed column, and that's the one he titled Never Retire. Even though I disagreed so much with many of his political beliefs, I admired this man so much, not just for his language usage, but for the way he lived his life. I mean, when he stepped down from his op-ed column at age 75, he wasn't retiring. He was getting ready to take on a whole new assignment as the director of this Dana Foundation that does, it's a nonprofit organization that, you know, promotes brain research. So he truly lived his life fully up to the very, very end. And for that, you know, he's got to be admired.
Right. And one more thing, the other thing that we remember is calling Hillary Clinton a congenital liar, saying later that he meant congenial lawyer. Right.
You know, that was a funny story. Do we have 1 second to
yes,
talk about
it? Yes, we do,
it?
Sure.
Well, this was the Travelgate scandal back in 1996 when these White House travel agents were fired and Hillary Clinton denied have anything to do with it. But it was pretty clear to almost all of the observers that she really did have something to do with it. So he refers to her as a congenital liar. And, of course, President Clinton, through his press secretary, says, when asked what his opinion about this comment was, he said, well, if he were not the president, he'd punch Sapphire in the nose. And when Sapphire was asked his opinion about it, he said he approved of the way the president phrased his conditional observation.
Oh, gee. Oh, so many stories. Thank you, Marty.
He had a great sense of humor.
Yes,
as well.
He did. Thank you so much. And so do you. We love having you on. Thanks.
Oh, thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks. Marty Grothy, author of Oxymoronica, Paradoxical Wit and Wisdom from History's Greatest Wordsmiths and Most Recently, Ifarisms, an anthology of aphorisms that begin with the word if. Joining us in just a moment, Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. We're remembering William Sapphire this hour of the program on the Ideas Network. Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, to talk about William Sapphire. Thank you so much for being with us, Will. To remember,
his,
yeah, thank you. Eric Alterman said in his book about Sapphire. One of the comments about Sapphire in the book: few insiders doubt that William Sapphire is the most influential and respected pundit alive. Was he?
Let me just say, the reason you asked me on your show, and I appreciate it, is because of something I wrote yesterday, or actually Sunday night, on my blog, Attitude, that I do for the Philadelphia Daily News. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to focus in a lot on what I want to talk about, I guess, is the influence of one particular period, which was just incredibly influential in Sapphire's life, and that was, and you were talking about this earlier in your show, about his speechwriting days for Spiro Agnew. Because to me, in an issue that I'm very concerned with these days is the role of the media in American society. And I think when he was writing those speeches about the nattering nabobs of negativism and the, what was it, the hysterical hypochondriacs of history, I'm missing one of the H's, but when he wrote those speeches, it was really part of a turning point in the way that the American public perceived the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's his real significance, in the sense that we've just seen this enormous erosion of trust in the mainstream media in American society over the last 40 years. And I think the Nixon-Agnew era, and the era of the so-called silent majority was the big turning point.
And Sapphire,
in his role of being kind of the linguistic point man for that, was just incredibly influential with his words.
Mm-hmm. And you say that that continues today, that it has kept people in the press from doing its job, stopping many of them from questioning authority?
Well, my point is this. I mean, the Nixon-Agnew campaign against the media, I think, really caught on with kind of the growing conservative movement in this country, the movement that built up to the election of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and has really continued to this day. And one of the core tenets of the conservative movement in this country is what I think kind of started out as distrust of the media and has really evolved over the years with the help of talk radio into hatred of the mainstream media. And I don't know if you or your listeners saw this poll by the Pew Charitable Trust a couple of weeks ago that found that now distrust of the media is at the all-time record high. And I think what's happened is, conservatives have continued to really distrust the media, and now the way things have played out over the years, I think liberals have and even a lot of centrists have added on to that, because I think the media has kind of flailed around in reaction to trying to appease a lot of its conservative critics, and I think you've seen liberals lose a lot of faith in the media as well.
He talked, Sapphire, that is, about that phrase "nattering nabobs of negativism" really being about people who had given up on Vietnam, except most people thought that it was an indictment of people in the press. Which was it?
I think you have to see it as both in this sense. I mean, Vietnam was obviously the issue of its day, and that was the thing that was really driving a lot of the day-to-day animosity during the Nixon years. But I think what you're seeing in a broader context is this notion that that people in the media are elites, that they're out of touch with mainstream America. A lot of my recent thinking on this has been influenced by an excellent book, if your listeners haven't checked this out, called Nixon Land by Rick Perlstein, that came out in 2008. And it really kind of analyzes not just Nixon himself, but really kind of the roots of conservative reactionism in this country, tracing it back to that era. And this notion of pitting, so-called regular Americans, unquote, against certain types of elites, which include the media, but also, academia, Hollywood, that sort of thing. I mean, it's really become a focal point in our modern politics. And I think the relevance of these speeches about nattering nabobs and negativism was they really kind of helped establish this war between regular folks, and the media, both engendering distrust. And one of the points that Perlstein makes in Nixon Land is that, the elites reacted to this, and the more the elites reacted and the more they got angry at Nixon and Andrew, the more it made conservatives turn against the press. So it was kind of this cycle that fed upon itself, in other words.
Mm-hmm. We're going to weave phone calls in and out of our conversations. Will Bunch is senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News and has a piece, which you can get online, William Sapphire, Nattering Nabobs and the Power of Words at philly.com. Let's go to Frank from Madison as our first caller for this discussion. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to say, since I'm about to say something negative, that Mr. Sapphire's passing is a matter of regret. But he was one of a representative, an early one, of the phenomenon of moving from being a political operative into the media in a way that is not the same as moving into objective journalism. And His boss once said that the communist conspiracy had to be stopped if every folk singer and bird watcher in the country had to be rounded up. And that might have been the staff of terrorism. But the general approach was to attack or game the ref and attack the messenger. And as your second guest is saying, this became standard procedure. So Mr. Sapphire was an ambiguous individual. And one could say in a different sense, and this is not to be negative about them, but say Diane Sawyer or Bill Moyers are also these individuals with this past in a political position. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
Yeah, I think the caller made a couple of excellent points there. And one thing that I didn't mention, which is worth pointing out, is he's right in the sense that you have Sapphire going from being a speechwriter for Richard Nixon to being a columnist for the New York Times. And I think if you look back it's a long time now, but I have some vague memories of his hiring at the time is being somewhat controversial because of his background with Nixon, and I think what I was talking about in my post on Attitude was the fact that the media looking to appease conservatives, and you saw this rush among newspapers to get op-ed columnists who were like William Sapphire or to run Sapphire's column syndicated and columnists like him, this sense that hey, we're not paying enough attention to conservatives, or we're not putting forth a conservative point of view, which is fine. I mean, obviously there is a place for that viewpoint in the paper, of course. I think where it's gotten dangerous as times evolved is I think there's been too much kind of kowtowing to conservative criticism by people who run the media.
Was Sapphire different in that he talked at one point about the offspring of pundits and saying that they are hot today because at their best, and I wonder if you could put him in this category, they can denote fresh reporting with an unconcealed point of view. Did he give us fresh reporting?
Yeah, I think one thing, and that might have surprised a lot of people about how he turned out as a columnist at the Times, was he did try and fit this role of being both, where he would try and report, your guests were talking about some of the scandals in the Clinton administration, like Travelgate, that he tried to report. And even near the end of his career at the Times, he was very active in trying to put out new information about supposed ties between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And of course, we know that story didn't really pan out, but it's very controversial. But he tried to combine that with a more traditional opinion columnist role. I mean, he's not the only person who does that, but I think that surprised people about him. But in the end, I think as a reporter, his record was mixed, as shown by the Iraq and some of the things about Clinton that he went after in terms of the scandals. He might have brought some new facts to light, but a lot of them didn't end up being as big a deal as he tried to portray them as initially.
Thank you so much, Will, for being with us. We enjoyed your column. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, and his piece on William Sapphire, Nadir Nabobs, and the Power of Words. And he believes that Sapphire's words have been very important for and had an enormous impact that has lasted until this day, is found at philly.com. Joining us now is Jay Nordlinger, journalist and senior editor for National Review. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Jay, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. Tell me how this guy, who used to make much of the fact that he was a college dropout, a public relations guy, was able to fashion this extraordinary career for himself. Where did he get all of it? Where did he get the words? Where did he get the political viewpoints? Where did he get the ideas of putting Nixon and Khrushchev together in Moscow? I mean, how did he fashion himself?
Well, he had talent. There's no way around it.
Yes, he did have talent.
He had native inborn talent. Very, very bright, brainy guy with a merry spirit, very personable, really, he couldn't miss. I mean, he worked very, very hard, as a lot of people do, but honestly, I think it was just native talent. He had this spark, and so the career was natural. And he was so versatile. You know, he'd write his political column, he'd write his language column, he'd write a novel, he'd write a history, and he didn't seem to break a sweat, kind of annoying to the rest of us.
And then he becomes chair of this foundation supporting research in neuroscience, immunology, and brain disorders when he's, what, 75 years old?
I'm not really sure where that came from.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a, well, he certainly had a knack for, well, not only using words, but we were talking earlier about this political moment in Moscow, which it, sometimes it's the moment in your life, right?
Yeah,
and Nixon
yeah.
looks at what he's done here, which is pretty extraordinary. It's in the press all over the world. He's taken the picture, too, in addition to getting them both in the same kitchen area, and it changed his life.
Well, you know, everyone needs a little break or a little crease, even the most talented, I guess. And he got that. He met Nixon. Nixon liked him. He was with him in 60. He was with him in 68 and beyond. And that reminds me, there was a time in my life when I was just a real political junkie, even more than now. And I read every White House memoir I could get my hands on. Everyone. There was about a two-year period where I just inhaled them like chocolate. And Sapphire wrote this memoir of the first Nixon administration called Before the Fall. I think, I hesitate to say this because I'll forget one and then maybe the memoir of someone I know and he'll be mad at me. But I think it's the best White House memoir I've ever read.
Hmm.
It is so stylish and insightful.
Hmm.
Makes you feel you really know Nixon and the people around him. It's just a superb book. I mean, it's not only wise and well-observed, it's fun. I think Sapphire was like that. All around, that's why I really didn't miss him. I tried not to miss him when he appeared. You could always learn something. You didn't always agree. Sometimes he would get under your skin,
right,
in a bad way. But you wanted to read him. At least I did.
So, what was his relationship with Nixon before the fall?
Good. He was in the inner circle. Certainly in the inner writer circle. There were three main guys, as I remember, a troika. Wonderful man named Ray Price. And then the famous or infamous Pat Buchanan,
mm-hmm.
and then Bill. And as far as I remember, the division of labor was like this. Ray, whom I know a little, call him Ray, not being cheeky, he wrote the kind of elegant, poetic stuff, inaugural addresses, stuff like that. Pat wrote the pugnacious political stuff, you know, red meat. Bill, he called himself an explainer. He wrote speeches that explained things, that got in the nuts and bolts of policy, policy speeches, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, they all did the various things, but as I remember from Sapphire's memoir, that was basically the division of labor, and it really worked.
Mm-hmm. And he became, I know he took some grief for his support of Nixon in some of his columns.
Mm.
Would you say it's fair to say that he distanced himself after the fall?
Oh, no, not distanced. He turned on Nixon.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. In complete, bitter opposition. Because those who were with Nixon the longest and had the most invested in him had the most to be bitter and upset about.
Mm-hmm.
And Sapphire, a lot of those guys felt absolutely betrayed by Nixon's lying and his cover-up. And then Nixon went ahead and wiretapped Sapphire. And Sapphire said, you know, geez, I gave so many years for Nixon in this cause, in the service of this politician and the nation at large, and this is my thanks. And so, you know, no, Sapphire and a lot of those guys did a real about-face.
Tell me about the Pulitzer that he won. It was for what he wrote about Burt Lance, Jimmy Carter's budget director, right?
That's a blast from the past, yeah.
Yeah, isn't it? That name I haven't heard forever.
No,
Burt Lance.
No, absolutely. He... Bill had an interesting column in that there was a lot of reporting in it. It's not as reporty a column as the Evans and Novak column, which was almost strictly a reporting column. I mean, Sapphire called himself a pundit, and he did have opinion, naturally. And, of course, most reporting has a bias. But he liked to report, and there were these scandals dealing with the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, and the Carter administration. And Burt Lance was an early casualty of that administration. But it, I think Burt Lance was a fine guy who may have done some some wrong things, but basically a good soul. But anyway, this reporting of Sapphire came to the attention of the Pulitzer Committee, and he won. It was kind of a big deal for an ex-Nixon guy to win a Pulitzer Prize. You know, a lot of people were upset about it. A lot of people applauded. And this brings a point. I suppose it falls to me to make this point since I'm a senior editor of National Review. You know, the New York Times, it was a much bigger deal in American life than it is today. I don't mean any disrespect by that. But the media have proliferated and democratized. We have many, many more choices. But I think it's hard for younger people, even the younger people on my staff, to realize just how important the New York Times was. It was the newspaper of record. Mm-hmm. Everybody read it. And those who didn't really read it, because all the journalists in the country read it and copied from it and put it in other papers. So it's hard to imagine today in 2009 just how huge it was. And Sapphire was the only right-of-center voice on that paper, the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And he carried the banner for people like me, and he was hugely important. And we wanted him to, well, you know, black Americans in the old days said, you know, when a black American achieved prominence, you better not mess this up, you know, we're all in it together, and don't make us look bad, you know,
right.
This feeling of a kind of racial solidarity, very understandable. There's some of this political solidarity as well, and Sapphire was her only spokesman on that paper, and a lot of us thought, oh, come on, Bill. You know, do us credit.
Mm-hmm. There have been. I was interested in a couple things that I've heard about him. I mentioned Daniel Schorr's tribute to him, that they used to break Yom Kippur fast together, and how desperately he'll miss him. The story about his being at the New York Times party, and one of the young sons falls into the swimming pool, and he jumps in with his suit on and saves the person and made himself friends among all the liberals who were at the party. Mm. That there seems to be... even though he had a decided point of view, was it a time when there was a little bit more friendship and respect among people of different political persuasions, or am I just romanticizing that era?
Well, that's interestingly phrased. I have always said, what you said, this is a line one hears. I'm not sure it was true. I know there was an immediate post-war consensus in the Eisenhower era, sort of the era of another era of good feelings, people called it, where people are basically a common view in the Cold War. And there really was there really all that much difference between John Foster Dulles and Dean Acheson? Really, really? I think this cleavage occurred with the so-called New Left in the mid-1960s and late 1960s and the early 1970s with the McGovern nomination and so on, when the JFK Democrats and the Humphrey Democrats kind of got shoved aside. And Vietnam had a lot to do with this. Watergate had a lot to do with this. Carter, interestingly enough, started out as a moderate to conservative Democratic president, but there's a lot of bitterness in that era. I really don't know. You know, Tip O'Neill, you know, he and Reagan used to joke that, you know, after 6 o'clock all arguments stopped and they were just good Irish buddies. And Reagan did this joke where, you know, O'Neill would come in the morning or the afternoon and Reagan would move the clock to 6. You know, that was kind of their shtick. But I remember the Reagan years pretty well. It was pretty darn unfriendly. And Sapphire said, you know, there are some years at the New York Times where no one in the building would make eye contact with him. Hmm. And I think it got friendlier later. You know, he was a Washington insider. He was with, who was that owner of the Redskins, Jack Kent Cook. He would be in his box for Redskins games, and he'd be at Kay Graham's table. And he was, he was kind of a token conservative in the Washington establishment.
Yeah. Well, another thing you brought up, Eisenhower, I didn't realize that he had organized, he really was a public relations guy, too, this huge rally for Eisenhower for president at Madison Square Garden. He was a big guy, isn't he, back in 50.
He was a hustler. He was a go-getter.
Yeah.
And you remind me of something. He was rare in a lot of ways. He was also rare in being a New York Jewish Republican.
Right.
And
right.
He was staunchly pro-Israel. He was hawkish on Israel. He was sympathetic to the Likud. And this was very, very rare in his paper and in his town. Very rare. And that's another thing that made his plumage bright, or at least stand out.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. We're speaking this part of our show with the senior editor for National Review. Chris is with us from River Falls. Hi, Chris.
When 12 men walked on the moon, they left behind 6 famous plaques. The first one read, quote, "Here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 A.D. We came in peace for all mankind." Two questions. Did Sapphire and the Nixon White House write these intending to insert religion? And is there an English usage error? I look at AD after July 1969, and I'm kind of fuzzy on this, but I recall that years later, Sapphire confessed that the AD should have been before the word July. But I'm no expert.
You have a good memory, and I don't know either. And I have a feeling you're right. We'd have to consult a Sapphire column. There was some dispute over what Neil Armstrong said, you recall, and some people think he botched his line. And I'm not sure that Sapphire didn't write that line. I believe the line was supposed to be, this is one small step for a man, a single man, an individual, one giant leap for mankind. I think Armstrong, and certainly he was under no pressure because nothing unusual was happening when he uttered this line, so I don't know why he botched it. A joke, by the way. I think he said this is one small step for man rather than putting in that article a man.
I know that Armstrong intended to say a man. By the way, what's not known historically is that as Armstrong was coming down the ladder, he saw a practical joke. Some men had inserted a sign on a drop-down flap that he had just activated. That might have made him nervous, and that might be why he blew his line.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And you think Sapphire wrote that line?
I think so. I've read this. I mean, he was a discreet guy. It's not like today where you go blabbing everything you wrote.
Right.
You know what Ted Sorensen answered when someone asked whether whether he had written JFK's inaugural address? He would answer, "Ask not." And I'll give you another wrinkle about that moon landing and Sapphire. I believe this is true. I'll need to check it. But, you know, they have speeches in reserve for everything, for any contingency. I think Sapphire had to write a speech in case the thing blew up and didn't come off and the astronauts were lost.
Mm.
I think that speech is extant.
Somebody's got it somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see it. Mm. Thanks, Chris, for your call. Let's go next to Sherilyn from Green Bay. Hi, Sherilyn.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, go right ahead.
This is about grammar. It's a column Sapphire wrote a couple of years ago about the correct uses of English. Like, you don't, when you answer the phone and somebody asks who it is, you don't say, "This is me." You say, "This is I," or "It is I." And he goes on to talk the whole article about how "it is me" has become very popular use, and the more popular use you get in those respects, the more correct it becomes. And the whole thrust of the article that was that you maybe could use either one or who cares, and I don't know. But toward the end of it, he said, if somebody corrects you on something you say about this sometime, just let them have it right between the "it is" eyes.
He loved puns. Absolutely.
Oh, I thought
loved
that was
puns
so
and jokes.
Cute.
That's funny.
I told a language story about Sapphire the other day that I love. He was talking about not being a language scold, not being a nuisance. And someone he hadn't seen for a while, an old friend he bumped into, said, "Oh, Bill, hello. I missed not seeing you." And Sapphire said, "Well, actually, you mean that you missed seeing me." And the guy, not liking to be corrected, paused and said, "Well, maybe I meant what I said the first time."
Thanks, Sherilyn, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to speak about William Sapphire. We're talking about his life this hour, many-faceted life. Jay Nordlinger is our guest journalist and senior editor for the National Review. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about William Sapphire this hour of the program, who, as you know, died on Sunday. Speechwriter for President Nixon, Pulitzer Prize-winning political columnist for the New York Times, prolific author, politics he wrote about, and also novels. And I liked our guest's description, a man with a merry spirit. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm wondering, you describe the Times as, you know, having all these liberal columnists and a liberal bent. Who decided to hire Sapphire?
Oh, geez, I should have come better prepared. I used to know this like the back of my hand. I can't remember. Someone took a risk. I don't know that Abe Rosenthal was executive editor at the time. I think he came later. I frankly can't remember, but I know it was a decision that caused much consternation.
Really?
Almost a world war. Oh, my goodness, this Nixon guy and this conservative guy. There really hadn't been a conservative on the page or anyone right of center. And he wasn't a social conservative. He called himself a libertarian conservative.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he voted for Clinton in 1992. But as conservatives like me say, he made up for it by being on Clinton's case for the ensuing 8 years. But he was sort of an eclectic guy in his political views. He was a civil libertarian, and people on the opposite side of that called Sapphire a privacy nut. Not a very nice phrase. He might have accepted it. This had a lot to do with being wiretapped by Nixon.
By Nixon,
and
yeah.
Understandably, that would radicalize you.
Why did Nixon wiretap him?
Can't remember. That was a lot of presidential paranoia, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was.
A lot of presidential paranoia.
Yeah. And so what do you think about the influence that he had? We were talking with another guest earlier from the Philadelphia Daily News who said that he thought Sapphire had this enormous impact on a distrust of the mainstream press after he had, you know, those words, the nattering nabobs of negativism, Spiro Agnew, which, you know, Sapphire said was against Vietnam defeatists, but people interpreted it as comments about the press that he believes were everlasting to now and keeps reporters from asking tough questions. Is there something to that, do you think?
I don't think so. No, I think the press has been pretty robust with Nixon and George W. Bush and some others. I think that Nixon and Agnew spoke for a lot of people when they expressed an upset over what we now call the MSM or mainstream media. And it was Pat Buchanan who coined the phrase instant analysis. Seems kind of quaint now. But it was new at the time. You know, the president would give a speech, and then pundits would appear immediately after on television to knock it down. I think Sapphire's main role, his influence was, I don't mean this impolitely in the least, but he, for maybe millions, he was the only conservative they ever read. You know, we all read the New York Times. Liberals, certainly Eastern Seaboard liberals, read the New York Times religiously, and he was the only one. So, in other words, he was some fiber in their diet, and that was extremely important. They didn't read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They probably didn't read Irving Kristol, who just passed on too a few days ago. Weren't reading National Review. Weren't reading the American Spectator. But if they wanted a little diversity in their media diet, they got Sapphire, along with, you know, Anthony Lewis and Scotty Reston and Flora Lewis and all the giants, you know. And so he, that was a great weight he carried. He was almost a one-man diversity columnist.
And why did people read him? Because he was really smart? Because he used words well? Or what made him...
All of the above. He was a little quirky. You know, we all read his last column in December every year was predictions for the next year. And then he'd revisit those predictions the next December and say how he messed up and make more predictions. and he was... you know, some people like to read people who annoy them or a little or even outrage them. And Sapphire could do that. He was pro-Israel, strongly so, and a lot of people weren't. He argued for what used to be called Reaganomics. And you remember Reagan said they stopped calling it that after his program began to succeed. And he was a different voice in the, we used to call that paper, The Gray Lady. And I think that was his main role. He was able to explain right-of-center positions to a broadly liberal audience. And, of course, now there are many, many more choices. I think we're not so captive or dependent. We used to have the three broadcast networks. We had the New York Times and Time and Newsweek, and everything filtered from them. I mean, people used to say, I remember conservatives complaining that all the people who mattered in the media worked within a few blocks of each other in Manhattan. That's no longer true. We've got this great big proliferation, and it's a messier age. Some people think we have too many choices, and who knows, maybe the media are more partisan than they once were, but it is Rupert Murdoch calls it a golden age of the media, not for the producer of news. He's in for very hard times, but for the consumer. We're not sure how to make money in this new age with the internet and so on.
Right.
Media people, but it's a very good age for the consumer.
Yeah. So would it be safe to say that he was a hero of yours, that he really helped direct your life because of what he did, broke ground?
That might be going a little far. My old late friend Bill Buckley was a hero of mine, and Norman Podhoretz at Commentary, and the aforementioned Irving Kristol.
Mm-hmm.
Sapphire had a huge, he had a big influence on me. He taught me a lot about politics. He comforted me. He entertained me. He had an influence on me where the Middle East was concerned.
Hmm.
Podhoretz did, too. I mean, I was raised in a very left-wing environment, was very anti-Israel, very pro-Palestinian. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. In fact, I was in a Near Eastern Studies program. I wouldn't say I was a radical, but I was, you know, sort of a PLO Nick. And I got turned around by the likes of Sapphire, and I learned a lot from him. I enjoyed his television appearances. Nightline used to be a very big deal with Ted Koppel. Anyone who didn't want to watch Johnny Carson watched Nightline.
Right.
And he was on it, Sapphire. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, he's a pretty cool cat.
He did a lot. He did a lot of meet the press, too, didn't he? He was all over.
Yeah, he was acceptable to the establishment.
Hmm.
And that's very, very important. You know, they kind of let him in. I've referred to him as a token. Tokenism is not a bad thing where political philosophy is concerned. You know, I think of faculties, for example. There ought to be a little political diversity on faculties, and there ought to be some political diversity on Meet the Press. And he handled that role very well, and George Will was there with him on another network, a few other biggies, James Kilpatrick, the guy they used to call
sure.
Kilpo,
mm-hmm.
broke through a little mainstream. But Sapphire was really mainstream, because you can't get more mainstream than the New York Times op-ed page.
Yeah. He must have enjoyed doing all of those political shows on television because he was a frequent guest.
Well, he looked like he was enjoying himself.
He did, yeah.
He really did. He had kind of a twinkle in his eye. He loved to crack a joke. He was a certain type of New Yorker.
And what about the language column, Jay, which he did just until very recently, until right before he died? Do you know where he got this love of words? And he was so good at it, and he obviously endeared himself to people of all political persuasions because it really wasn't a political column, and a lot of people love language.
Some of us are born with that love, and I say us not in a conceited way. I love it. I don't say I'm a master of it, like Sapphire, but I just think it's something like you like baseball or butterflies or rock collecting. Some people just love it. And I think the thing that made Sapphire's column so successful is it was entertaining and light, and yet it made serious points. And he was not a scold. He was not a prescriptionist or prescriptivist. I can't quite remember the word. He was not a language scold or nuisance. He just loved language and liked to talk about slang and usage. And I don't think he cared all that much whether you used correct English. And neither do I. I just like to write about it, and I think it's neat. And I love colloquialisms. I love, you know, new lingo that arises. And the column was very, very good in that way. He didn't make you feel bad. He wasn't wagging his finger at you. He was just having fun.
Mm-hmm. I liked his comments on not retiring, the final column that he wrote, in which he talked about this avocation that you should have when you're in the early part of your career, which will help you with your brain health toward the end of your career. And it must have been, well, it is also the work he did on neuroscience, but it must have been his language column, too, that that was an avocation and kept him really smart and alive and functioning until very recently.
Well, you remind me of something else about Sapphire. You've just put this in my head. There are some people who are natural enthusiasts.
Right. Yes.
I sort of envy them in a way. They just kind of, they wake up bubbling, you know, that type. and they have passions, and if they like food, they really like food. If they like the opera, they really like opera. And
if they
get onto neuroscience, as I think Tom Wolfe did too, the novelist, you know, they go about it with his best.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He seemed that type.
Yeah.
He always struck me as, you know, obviously there are clouds in every life, and I can't remember much about his family situation. But he seemed to enjoy life. He went at it with relish.
I think I remember reading, because I always read that part of obituaries, he must have been married for a long time. He survived by his wife, two children, and a grandchild. I think that's what it is.
And I remember his brother, he always kept the original family spelling, which was without the E at the end. and like Sefer.
Hmm.
But they said sapphire, but Bill added the E for ease of pronunciation.
Thank you ever so much for being with us, Jay. It was delightful to have you on the air. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Our guest this half hour, Jay Nordlinger, journalist and senior editor of National Review, who talked about how enormous William Sapphire was in the world of journalism, conservative, libertarian, I guess he called himself, who achieved such prominence. All right, well, that was an interesting hour. We thank Marty Grothy with us for being with us the first part of the show, author of Oxymoronica, Paradoxical Wit and Wisdom from History's Greatest Wordsmiths, and he's also the author of a wonderful new book, Ifarisms. Also, Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, and then, of course, Jay Nordlinger, who was just with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for producing this hour on the life of William Sapphire. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks to you for participating. We have news coming up in just one moment from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour of conversation talking about the health of the Great Lakes. So that's on the air shortly. This is the Ideas Network.